the VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 383, recorded on April 3rd, 2015.
Welcome to the 383rd edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 216th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
And I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and often includes other segments.
But not today.
Mysteriously, without warning.
Not this week. You might know that this is actually a very quick turnaround since we recorded on Monday and we're just doing this a couple days later.
Yeah, we're trying to get back on our regular schedule.
On a regular schedule, which is why there's no reader feedback, because we're just doing this too fast for anybody to reply.
Because nobody had time.
Nobody had time. Although, you know what? The question of the week should still stand, because Paul liked it.
Because Paul has many intelligent and insightful answers to today's issues.
Yeah, well, you know, today's issues are just depressing, so we'll just stick with video games.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So, Paul, what have you been playing?
Honestly, I have been playing a board game with a companion app that I have become absolutely fascinated
by. Don't tell me it's XCOM.
No, it's called Alchemists.
Oh, yes. I actually saw people playing that.
By Mattis Cotroy.
Yes, I saw that.
I think it's brilliant, and I need to study it in greater detail.
All I know is I haven't played it. I don't know the rules, but people were saying, oh, no, debunked. Sorry. Debunked.
Oh, debunked.
Yeah, because people are trying, in that game, from what I understand, people are making all these experiments and trying, you know, this will create this. And they're trying to.
And this is why you need a game designer on this show. So essentially, the game works in that narratively, the players are all at magic school trying to learn the properties of the 8 magical ingredients of the world.
Basically, Hogwarts the game.
Pretty much. So, or potions class, the game. So the only way to figure out what the magical properties are of any given ingredient are to test it against something else. So it's kind of like if you enjoyed high school math logic tables back in Sequential 1, you'll really enjoy this game. So yeah, I've only played it a handful of times, and I need to see more of it in action. But I am, as a designer, I'm fascinated, and I love the concept of a companion app. But I see already how it needs to be done properly.
Right. I actually
like you can't just throw an app out there because it's like, what if somebody doesn't have an iPhone? What if somebody needs to do this, you know, analog? So in this particular game, you know, it's anywhere from 2 to 4 players, but unless you have the app, another person has to be like the information keeper of the game. It's kind of like if you ever played Clue, you know how like once you look at the confidential file to see whether or not you're right, if you're wrong, you're just out of the game.
Right.
You need the one person in this game who is able to just look at the confidential file and tell people what's going on. It's like Clue, but nobody has any cards to debunk each other.
It's really an amazing coincidence. I played a game which is also Hogwarts the board game, but it was a different game.
Really?
It was called Argent the Consortium, and this one is more of a worker placement game in which you put your little magic users, and they're different colors, and each color has a different power. And, you know, you put them on, oh, I want to research this spell, I want to get money and mana, that sort of stuff, and you're working towards... See, the entire point of the game are to get approvals from the higher-ups of the university, like who has the most IP, who's the most important, who has the most purple mages, who did the most types of magic, that sort of thing, you know, who has the most mana, but you don't know which of the upper class, you know, the deans are going to be there. You can peek using, by using these marks. You put a mark on one of the turned down cards, and then you look under it. No one else knows what it is. You know, so you're basically doing that. But basically, you know, it's like you're trying to do all this stuff, magic research, getting spells. You know, there's some offensive stuff, like you can knock people out of rooms and lock them with a fireball, that sort of stuff. I did really, really poorly the first time I played, but that's because I really didn't know what I was doing. You know how it is when you first play a board game. You haven't quite grasped what the mechanics are, you know, and what a winning strategy would be. But I think if I played again, I would do a lot better. So, yeah, Argent the Consortium. So you might want to check that one out too, Paul.
Fair enough.
It's someone also described it as Lords of Waterdeep meets Hogwarts, you know, that sort of thing.
I don't know Lords of Waterdeep.
Oh, that's a D&D worker placement game. That I have on my iPad.
Oh, yeah, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah, well, actually, it's really, really fun. I have it on my iPad, and it contains all the expansions. Normally, to get the board game with the expansion, it costs like $90.
Okay.
But my iPad app with the expansion costs, if I remember correctly, $12. And it's exactly like the board game, except you're playing with computer opponents. However, I'm thinking about getting the physical board game with the expansion as well, because there's something to be said of having a physical board game and playing with a bunch of people around the board and physically touching the pieces and moving around and conversing with people. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I might do that just to, you know, just to be able to do that. So, yeah, those
fair enough.
There's the board games we were playing. Have you been playing any other games?
Well, it's only been like 4 days. I did try to play the Easy Peasy RPG.
Okay.
I don't know, but like literally, like just the letters Easy Peasy RPG. Its hook is that it's an RPG that will play itself for you. Like while you're away, you don't have to like worry about grinding.
Oh, okay. I was about to say that sounds like Final Fantasy 13, but no, you're talking about one of those games in which you instruct a character to do something, and then you come back later and you see what they've done.
Well, it's an iOS game, and I instantly don't like it. I mean, I instantly just do not like it. I mean, the hook is there, like it delivers on the fact that it does stuff while you're not playing, but it has that low barrier to entry where it's like, oh, you don't have to really understand everything. But then it gives you all these complex layers of things that you don't really have to care about. Like it's trying to be an incredibly complex Final Fantasy with a button that says play this game, you know, on autopilot. But the problem is that once you make that decision, there's no point in trying to understand all this complex stuff. So you just get a lot of numbers being thrown at you for no reason, and it's all completely out of context. I think it's kind of an epic fail, frankly, from the player standpoint.
I actually played a game a long, long time ago. It was an AD&D game which boasted that it had a real dungeon master, sort of.
Okay.
But what happens in it is that it was basically a war game, right?
Uh-huh.
But one of the things was that you could send your PC. See, the thing is that when you're in the battle, you have tons of, you know, troops, you know, who are nothings, you know, who can get killed really easy. But when you're controlling a PC, they can really, you know, kill, and you know, they last a long time on the thing and on the board, you know, and they're really, really valuable. What you can do is that you can send them off to do a mission of various difficulties. And if they come back, they level up, and they usually find a magic item or something like that, or they get killed, which really annoys me. But then again, if you take a big risk, then you know. But that was the sort of thing I always that I enjoyed. Are those games in which you know you send your guy off? Okay, go do your mission over there, and hopefully you'll come back with loot and stuff, and you'll level up a bit. You know. I mean, it can be implemented really, really well. It just sounds like you really weren't connecting with this one.
Yeah, I mean, from my personal perspective, I think it's a game like Alchemists, where it's, you know, or the other D&D game that you were mentioning, is kind of like the opposite end of the spectrum of this new Toys to Life category, where, you know, like, Infinity is like buy this toy that is not articulated. It's, you know, in a frozen pose. and most of its functionality is on the game platform. This is, you know, kind of the other end of the spectrum, where most of the game is in the physical world, and it's a companion app or some other piece of technology that's helping you run it in the background. So how cool would it be to be able to go back and play something like HeroQuest from back in the day, without the need to have a third person? You know, you and just one friend could play it and type in what quest number you're doing, and the app could tell you what to do. Or, you know, an even more traditional game, which is still around, Scotland Yard, which I don't have in front of me, but it's something. I could see it. It's in German. The moniker comes over the corner of the box. I want to say Riven's
something or other. Don't strain your brain too much.
I'm just saying that, like, any of these board games that at one point had traditionally required someone to take on a different role from the rest of the group, you know, we can now kind of begin to look at those games in a new way because of this kind of hybrid technology. And that's what that's the kind of thing that I'm finding fascinating this week.
Okay.
You know, I think that while there will always be a place for, like, family type games, you know, your Monopolies, your Sorry, your Life, that as people look for new and more complex, experiences, we're going to see the rise in popularity of things like Alchemist and Scotland Yard that require more in-depth gameplay among younger audiences, frankly. And removing the physical barrier of, like, Monopoly, where somebody has to be the banker, will probably make those games even more popular. So that's why I was kind of studying this area.
Okay. Are you still playing The Sims Free Play?
I am playing The Sims Free Play, awaiting my answer from Something Dogs. What was it?
Oh, yeah. You had a complaint about spending, having to do something 70 times and basically spending much.
Yeah. So I wrote to let me just look up the name of the company real fast, because I never remember anything. I know that I sent you my conversation.
Yeah, you did. You sent me the letter to EA demanding that you get some financial justice.
Yes, and what the heck was the name of this company? Hold on a second. I'm sorry, I'm just going to edit this part out.
This is scintillating radio, folks.
Hey, I didn't know we were going to talk about this soon.
Really?
Well, I didn't really have any.
Well, the name of the developer to is Fire Monkeys.
Thank you, Fire Monkeys. I was going to say Fire Puppies, but that would have been wrong. So I wrote to Fire Monkeys, and I'm like, look, you've put up, you've set an undoable task where the only way to accomplish it was to pay hard currency. And while I don't particularly mind that, you've also misrepresented the ratios that something was able to be won at. You know, basically it made it look like it was a 1 in 12 or a 1 in 20 shot, when it really turned out to be closer to 1 in 70. And that's not acceptable. So either this is a bug, or you're trying to rip me off and I'm just going to quit your game. So I kind of wrote them, look, you should give, I'm hoping that this is just a bug and you will refund my hard I'm not even asking for, like, my money back. I'm asking for my hard currency back, so I can continue to play their game and buy other stuff with the money I've already spent, because they gave me no value for my hard currency, or I'm just going to continue to bash their game and not play it. So, I mean, if anybody's interested, I'm more than happy to I'm more than happy to read the copy of the letter that I sent. I sent it to Jonah so it wouldn't get lost. It was like, look, you kind of took my money for no reason by setting up an impossible challenge. I don't know if you meant to do that. If you didn't, you'll make good on it. But if you did, I'm going to stop playing your game.
Yeah. We're going to move on to game news. Go ahead, Paul.
Microsoft discontinues Kinect for Windows, and this comes to us from Eurogamer. Microsoft has consolidated its Xbox One and PC models of Kinect into one, the Xbox One version with an optional Windows adapter. Quote, over the last several months, we have seen unprecedented demand from the developer community for Kinect sensors and have experienced difficulty keeping up with requests in some markets, explained Microsoft senior technology evangelist for Kinect, Michael Fry, on the company blog.
As such, rather than worry about stocking two very, very similar models of Kinect in various markets, Microsoft figured it would be simpler to just have one version. Quote, the Kinect adapter enables you to connect a Kinect with a K for Xbox One sensors to Windows 8 and 8.1 PCs and tablets in the same way as you would connect for Windows version 2 sensor, Fry said. And because both Kinect with a K for Xbox One and Kinect with a K for Windows version 2 sensors are functionally identical, our Kinect for Windows SDK 2.0 works exactly the same with either. Those who already own a Kinect for Windows version 2 sensor will be happy to hear that Microsoft will continue support this model, even if it's been discontinued at retail.
Well, it's kind of easy. I'm willing to bet you they're both the exact same piece of hardware, just with different
ports. Just with different adapter plugs at the end.
Yeah.
That was my thought.
So, you know, I mean, it's good to consolidate. And, you know, most of the stuff that's done with Kinect for Windows has been robotics. You know, robots that can see. And, you know, that's kind of neat. I mean, they've been doing some amazing things. I don't know if you remember, like, 6 years ago, people were doing lightsabers with the Kinect and doing all these other fun little stuff that you wish they would actually, you know, manage to incorporate into a game.
Right. So I've seen a lot of technology demos with a Kinect, but not a suitable game experience. I mean, I know that even Joe Rowling tried doing a Harry Potter something or other.
J.K. Rowling, and yeah, they did have
Harry Joe Potter. Rowling.
They had
her name's Joanne.
Harry Potter Kinect game, and it did work really well because all you were doing was waving your hand to simulate having a wand.
It wasn't like an unreleased chapter of Harry Potter where the fan base for that thing would have gone in droves to find out more of this world that she's created. It was kind of innocuous.
Well, it wasn't even a separate game, though. It was just a Harry Potter game that was multi-platform, but they added a Kinect element to the Xbox 360 version, if I remember correctly.
But it wasn't a no. I think it was a Kinect.
I think
exclusive.
So. There was two. Actually, I know one of the games was just Kinect added, and I think another one was a wand waving game or something like that. Yeah.
The point is, it seemed to have more associated with being a tech demo rather than an interesting new story in that universe, its own game,
right.
Really, which is probably why they needed more of a designer on that team, too.
Well, there were two games that really worked well with the Xbox Kinect.
Animals? Connectimals?
No. Well, actually, yeah, I wasn't even thinking of that, but Fruit Ninja did really, really well with the Kinect. It was, you know, because all you were doing was using your hand, your arms. You know how you do it in the iOS game. You use your fingers and touch the screen and
right.
And what's it called? But this one, you just waved your arms, and it was really fun. But I'll tell you something, that game gave me tired arms after like 15 minutes. I mean, it was so frantic, you know, and you spend all your time waving your arms around. Actually,
like you just don't care.
Yeah, actually, I forgot Dance Central, and I forgot all, and also the Fantasia game that they currently released for the Xbox One. That one does the Kinect really, really well too.
Right, it does it really, really well. But how much of a commercial success is it?
It's been a fairly good success, actually, from what I.
Yeah, but it's been in development for like 6 years.
Really?
I mean, is it recouping its investment?
I think so.
And if so, is it recouping its investment more than taking that same amount of developing money and putting it in a stable bond fund?
Well,
because I mean, you have to come up with a percentage that's higher than that.
Well, let's put it this way. They've started doing Rock Band 4. So apparently something happened that allowed them to have enough money to start doing that again. The other one, and I keep forgetting the name of it, was one in which you were firing a cannon and trying to hit goblins, and you could use Kinect to move it, and also sometimes it'll allow you to use your arms to guide it. You know, that was a really fun game. And they're redoing that with Scream Ride, although that's not a Kinect game. Have you heard of Scream Ride?
No.
Okay, so Scream Ride is it's Roller Coaster Tycoon, except you're guiding the roller coaster track, and a lot of times you're making them go off the rails and try to crash into stuff and knock things down on purpose.
Sounds exactly like Roller Coaster Tycoon.
No. But in this case, you're trying to destroy things. But you're also you're also moving back and forth to guide the make it go faster and all that stuff. It's kind of hard. The thing is, it started out as a tech demo, because it was a new engine, you know, new physics engine. Right. And it was just so fun. They said, you know what? Let's make a full game out of this. And they did. And it's gotten a lot of positive reviews. It's a $40 game, if I remember correctly. You know, one of those budget games, quote unquote. Although, you know, to me, a budget game was
$40 is not a budget game.
Well, it is now. But I'm just saying, it used to be that $20 was a budget game. $30 was a budget game. I mean, now $40 is a full DS game.
This sounds like an elaborate tech demo that they're just trying to get some money back so that they could use that tech for something else.
You know what? They kept on building on it, said it was a game in its own right, you know, and it is pretty fun.
Are you sure?
Yes.
I don't think that word game means what you think it means.
Anyway, Scream Ride is really fun. Check it out. There's a demo on Xbox Live. Not that you can access it. But getting back to Kinect, you know, I mean, I use Kinect all the time, but the thing is, I'm always telling my Xbox to, and I have to be careful because if I say the wrong thing, my Xbox will do weird stuff. Oh, see, it just did something. It heard me say that word.
Yeah, because that's what we all need in our homes.
Well, anyways,
listening to us.
I use my console to watch TV, change channels without touching the remote, you know, go to YouTube, that sort of stuff. And I don't know. I've gotten so used to having voice command on my Xbox One that, you know, I find it crude to pick up a controller and navigate the screen when I have to.
That's just because you're lazy.
It's lazy because it's induced it. I mean, but, you know, you can watch TV. See, it went to one guide. I don't know what I said to make it do that. Xbox, go back. There we go.
Well, as fascinating as that might be.
So, anyways. But, yeah, I mean, like I said, I use my Kinect for mostly utilitarian stuff now. I don't actually use it to play a game, although I do want to get Fruit Ninja version 2. And you don't need to even stand up for that. You can just sit down and wave your arms around.
So we're removing the physical aspect from it. Gotcha.
Well, what do you mean? No. You're still going to...
You don't even have to stand up anymore.
Well, you know, if Jordan was on this podcast, he'd say, thank God. You know, some people can't stand for very long periods of time.
Which is fine. We can have other gameplay experiences for those that don't wish to stand.
Yeah. I mean, you could actually use a Kinect by raising up your one arm and you know, pointing at the screen and opening and closing your arms to do stuff. But I just like to talk, you know.
Oh, believe me. We all know that.
Uh-huh. That's the pot calling the kettle black right there.
I've been trying to move us along to the next news story.
Okay, well, the next news story is also about Microsoft. Microsoft says open source Windows is quote unquote definitely possible from PC Gamer. Windows has been around for a long time. It's made a lot of money, and Microsoft quite naturally has been very protective of it. In fact, so protective of it that Paul refuses to upgrade from XP until they get something that he loves.
They will pry this operating system out of my cold, dead hands. But please continue.
But times, they are changing, and Microsoft may one day have and Microsoft may one day have to change with them in ways that once would have been unimaginable. Windows is still a big dog in the OS marketplace, but alternatives, such as the open source Linux, are making inroads that can't be ignored. Open source titles are biting onto their Microsoft-dominated markets as well, this particular report being typed on an open source and remarkably good OpenOffice. Now, for those of you who don't know, Paul, why don't you describe what open source means?
It means that anyone can see the code and use it and build upon it to customize it in whatever way they imagine.
Yeah. And so
it's the exact opposite of something being proprietary. So in the way that Nintendo is like, if you open your Wii, you will void the warranty. That's a proprietary mindset. The reversing that in that example would be like, hey, go ahead, open it up, you know, change the case, put more RAM in there if you want, you know, whatever. We don't care. Just, yeah, you know, buy us for, you know, pay us for the initial bundle of parts.
Right, like, and that's how homebrew starts. Like, people have been making homebrew Atari 2600 games and homebrew NES games, stuff that was that was made strictly from cracking open the 2600, the NES, or other consoles, and making games from that. You know,
right. So while it does put power back into the hands of the consumer, it also starts to make you wonder, well, what's in it for the companies that are making the, you know, the initial installment of these things? You know, are they going to be able to pay their bills?
Right.
So it's a tricky kind of road to start walking down.
Well, speaking of that road, the shift is significant enough that Mark Russinovich, the CTO of Microsoft Azure, acknowledged that the three-day chef conference, really? They were at a conference for chefs?
I have seen more conference names that I can keep straight in the last few weeks, so I've just decided to start calling them all What's It Con or That Con.
Well, ChefConf 2015 says it's, quote unquote, it's definitely possible that Microsoft could one day make Windows open source. It's a new Microsoft, he said. Every conversation you can imagine about what you would do, every conversation you can imagine about what we should do with our software, open versus not open versus services, has happened. Having conversations is a long way from actively planning to make the change, but simply acknowledging that somebody somewhere has discussed the possibility is a big change in attitude. As Facebook engineer Phil Dibowitz told Wired, this wouldn't have happened 2 years ago. And let's not forget that Windows 7 and 8 will be able to upgrade to Windows 10 at no charge for up to a year after its release. That too would have been unthinkable in the past. So open source Windows, entirely hypothetical, but not off the table. So what would the effect of, say, an open source Windows be, say, for someone who's, you know, in your line of work, Paul?
You know, it kind of sounds like Microsoft has seen the writing on the wall here, that people are becoming less and less afraid of technology and, like, you know, just being able to do things for themselves in general. They're becoming more self-reliant. I mean, you know, look at tax preparation software commercials. You know, they're like, hey, you could do this yourself. It's not that hard. So I kind of think that Microsoft is sensing the change in the American consumer where they're less intimidated by technology. Because they're being raised on it. So they're trying to figure out their next business model because the one that they had from the 80s isn't going to work anymore.
In the 90s. Now, keep in mind, you know, like as far, I think maybe as in like the early 2000s, Microsoft owned something like 95% of the market when it came to PC OSs, you know, that sort of thing.
Right. But how much do they own now? Well, and are they predicting
like 85%? But that 85% is almost a disaster for Microsoft, I think.
Right. And I think that it explains it back exactly to my point, is that they're seeing they've lost market share and that they're continuing to lose market share. So, like, they're going to try to figure out what their next thing is.
Yeah. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Like I said, this person was writing the software on something called OpenOffice. How would developing on a PC be different with Windows if you could open source it?
Not being a developer, I wouldn't be able to answer that question.
Well, you said
I don't consoles. Code games, and we've had this conversation several times.
You could change. I guess you could change Windows. That's basically what's happening.
I mean, from my point of view, it sounds like a disaster because if someone is going to change their PC in such a way that they can't open an image that I've created or a document that I've written, then it's going to be like, come on, you're the one person on the team who isn't on the same page with the rest of us. Like, fix your computer that you fucked with.
Yeah. And well, that's just it. You know, if you want to change your Windows, Microsoft seems to be saying, go ahead. But you know what? When you change it, it's no longer stable, you know?
Right. And that's, and you know, that's not just a perception.
That's
the truth. Yeah. So it's like, because you as an individual, if you change something, you don't have the kind of resources to test it or debug it or patch it when you find an issue the same way that a company like Microsoft would. Mm. Now, granted, you know, no piece of software has ever been released without bugs, but at least, you know, they have a customer service department where somebody can, you know, find something, contact them, and they can act on it. You as an individual, you might not know how to solve why your computer keeps crashing every time you press the F4 button by accident, you know? And it's like, it's going to make your thing unstable. And Lord knows what it's going to do, what that bug is going to introduce errors into your
files and documents.
You know, I just,
so it's, I mean, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword.
Well, I just realized it goes the other way too, though. If Windows is open source, Microsoft suddenly has a couple million beta testers who are going to let them know when they found a bug and how they fixed it. You know, and Microsoft can see what they did and test it for themselves. And if they did it, they give them thumbs up and say, good job, you know. Maybe even give them some money for fixing a bug, you know. Because when you open source Windows,
possibly,
you know, I mean, it does allow people to feel more involved in the product. And that's one of the major things, whether your console or PC. When the consumer feels involved in the product they own, they become more loyal. That's why you have so many people who are steadfastly Linux, you know, lovers. You know, they won't do anything having to do with Windows because they love their Linux, you know. I mean, there is something called customer loyalty.
It's possible. And I think it's less about customer loyalty when it comes to Linux and more about screw the man. Why should we pay to have Big Brother updating our software when we can just go and do it ourselves?
Well, no.
And so while I'm not going to say that that's like the core, I could definitely see that as part of the Linux brand.
Well, I think that's most of the Windows. Also, they have a penguin as their mascot. And how can you go wrong with a penguin?
Okay, well, now that we've devolved into that argument.
Moving on.
OnLive shuts down streaming game services, sells patents to Sony. And this comes to us from Ars Technica. The first company to try to make a business out of streaming gameplay over the internet will soon be shutting down its service. OnLive announced today that it servers will go offline on April 30th, and that the company is selling its portfolio of patents to Sony Computer Entertainment America. The announcement comes almost exactly 6 years after OnLive first announced its plans to the nascent streaming game space.
You know, wait a minute. 6 years ago, you know, that was 2009. I thought OnLive had been around for a lot longer than that. It's just so recent, it seems to me.
The idea was to take in user input over the internet, put it through a game running on high-end software at a centralized server location, then send back video and audio to end-user hardware that could be significantly cheaper and less powerful. So this is essentially the very definition of cloud gaming.
Yeah, and live streaming, yeah.
Right. The service and a $100 micro console launched in late 2010, but it suffered from noticeable latency and image quality issues in our initial tests.
Our meetings are Technica.
With its pay-per-game service and a limited subscription-based streaming model failing to connect with many consumers, OnLive faced massive layoffs and a dramatic business restructuring in 2012. The company soldiered on to launch a new hybrid streaming-slash-downloadable game plan last year, though. Players who took part in that hybrid plan will still be able to play their purchased game through Steam, but streaming games purchased... Will you stop that?
What?
But streaming games purchased through CloudLift or the older PlayPass subscriptions could no longer be usable after the end of the month. OnLive will continue to exist as a corporate entity to manage remaining unsold assets, such as trademarks, copyrights, and production designs. Streamable PS3 game selection is a bit lacking, but service provides a good sampler. Since OnLive launched, larger, more established companies have followed its lead, trying to stream games over the internet. Sony purchased OnLive competitor Gaikai back in 2012.
Gaikai, but who's counting? The thing is that OnLive was way too ahead of its time. It was at a time in which, you know, it had the right idea, but, you know, people just didn't have the online connections to really take advantage. I mean, now things are faster, but I still think it's too early.
Well, it also sounds like its games catalog wasn't exactly there.
Yeah, I mean, that was the other thing, is that it didn't really have a great library. The thing is, I don't even know if we're ready for it now.
Do you don't think that if Nintendo were to release a $100 or $150 console where all the games are going to be released digitally, that it would work?
Well, Microsoft tried to do that with Xbox One, and it was a disaster.
Well, I mean, with their catalog of I mean,
Are you saying retro games?
Not even retro games, but let's look at it this way. Microsoft and Nintendo have a very different concept of what kind of game they want to have on their platform and the audience that they want to reach. So while this service might not work for a Microsoft model where we're talking about high fidelity graphics and super responsive, immediate point and shoot action, a game like Mario, where there's less textured graphics, and let's face it, a platforming engine is going to be a lot simpler to run than a first-person shooter engine. I mean, they're just different types of games. So I think that this service might, or this business model might work very well for a Nintendo type company where it hasn't for Sony and Microsoft.
Well, they did have something like that for South America. I think something called Zeebo or something like that, in which, it was very inexpensive, extremely inexpensive micro console in which people just, it wasn't live streaming, but it was like, you want to play this game? Okay, hold on while we download it. And now you can play it, you know, and after you're done, it'll delete itself. Right. I mean, they did have something like that.
Well, I mean, personally, nothing is more frustrating than wanting to go and play a game or even like use your console to watch Netflix and have to wait 30 minutes because you need to do a mandatory software update and then a mandatory app update, and just to make sure that people like aren't pirating. It's like, I just want to use what I paid for. Like, why do I have to wait half an hour?
Well, actually, you know, but say you use the Nintendo's back catalog and, you know, sort of like, yeah, the NES, Super Nintendo, you know, and maybe even the Nintendo 64 stuff that you could stream, you know. That wouldn't take up much space, right? There would be relatively simple games. You know, the entire back catalog on a micro console that's maybe like $75 with a subscription of like $5 a month. You know, you could play any old Nintendo game streaming, so it's impossible to really pirate unless you have an account. I mean, that's...
Right, I mean, and there shouldn't be anything wrong with that, especially when you're talking about over the last 5 consoles, a library of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of games.
Yeah, and you know, you say, do you remember Battletoads? Oh, sure, let's play it now. Okay, let's go. Okay, we're going to play...
See, that's the thing, though. They're not... Battletoads was a great game in its day, but that IP isn't getting the kind of marketing support that it did back in the 90s. No, so how many people are going to be able to go back and be like, oh, Battletoads is an awesome game. We should all go play it. I mean,
But you would be playing the original version or say, oh, let's go play Athena or let's play Kid Icarus or what, you know, just...
Oh, right, but I mean, but to Nintendo's core audience right now, Kid Icarus is just, you know, Pit is just this kid in Smash Brothers that they don't know where he comes from.
Well, that's just it.
You know what I mean? And they're probably not going to, once they see the original, not all of these games age well. You know, once they see the original Kid Icarus, they might be pretty damn bored.
I have a magazine subscription to something called Retro, which just deals with old stuff. And they have a console. I think we've seen it before, in which it has, like, the NES, the Famicom, the Super Famicom, the Super Nintendo, the Nintendo 64, the Sega Genesis, you know, all of it all in one, you know, that people do, you know, and people play the entire library of those games on that emulator, you know. Just picture being able to have, say, something the size of a GameCube, or even smaller than a GameCube, you know, being able to play all those, you know, old games, you know. And like I said, you know, but the retro feel would be part of its charm. I mean, how many games have we seen come out that deliberately try to make themselves look 8-bit or 16-bit? You know? I mean, Mega Man 10 and 9 and 10 came out looking like they were just released from the Nintendo yesterday. So.
If you say so.
Well, it's, you know, it's true, though. I mean, it does all gaming have to, you know, be aimed at teenagers, really? I mean...
Well, I mean, that's kind of my raison d'etre, is that no. I mean,
we're talking to a person here, and we keep on saying it week after week after week, who bought the same 1985 Legend of Zelda over and over and over and over again.
Because it's an awesome game.
See, there you go. And, you know.
But, I mean, do I feel the need to have it on the Wii U? No.
I mean, Atari, Space Invaders on the Atari 2600 still holds up.
Does it, though? Yeah, it holds up for about 15 minutes. It holds up for about 15 minutes.
Well, I mean, the game itself, but it still holds up in terms of gameplay.
Right.
For about 15 minutes.
Oh, not...
Because well, there are just so many other things you could go do with your time.
But you play competitively in that, you know, unlike Space Invaders in the arcade. So you still have that thing in which you're trying to beat your friend, you know. So there's that. And you can also make your ship really, really big so that it's easier for the aliens to hit, giving you that little difficulty spike. Anyways, but I'm just saying, you know...
We are fantastically off topic.
Not really. We're still talking about streaming. We're talking about a Nintendo streaming console. And the
right. I definitely think Nintendo could easily make a budget console that is just a streaming of their old catalog.
Right. Would you buy it?
Would I buy it? Possibly.
Okay.
Depends what the price point is. Depends on how many of their old... Because, I mean...
But they already have their foot in the door because you said possibly. That's
you know what it would... You know what would be fantastic? Would be if it had a slot on it.
Uh-huh.
That I mean, because the original Zelda is 7K worth of memory. I mean, come on, like little, like go look it up. It's 7K.
Yeah.
Like it would be fantastic if I could like plug my cartridge in and be like, "Here's proof that I have Zelda. Download it to my thing, and this way, let me box this up and put it in storage because I'm tired of keeping it in my apartment."
You know, 7K, and the music is the thing that people remember most from it. You know. And the music in Legend of Zelda is still pretty sophisticated. It's 8-bit tunes, but still it has a melody that's kind of long, you know. Very little repeat.
Well, for its day it has very little repeat. But, I mean we're talking about 60 seconds at most before it loops back.
Yeah, but it's still 7K though. See, that's my point. I mean, 7K.
Right.
How many characters is that in a word processor now? You know,
7K. It's a lot.
Yeah. Mario Maker gets a release date, and this comes to us from IGN. Nintendo President Satoru Iwata announced today that Mario Maker, the Wii U game that lets you build custom Super Mario stages, will be releasing this September. The release is just in time for the 30th anniversary of the original Super Mario Bros., which debuted in 1985, which, by the way, Paul, is the same year that guess which game came out? Yes, Legend of Zelda. Iwata spoke brief... Wait a
minute. You're saying that as if I wasn't there for that, Jonah.
Wait a minute. So, okay... I have a question.
You're saying I was alive in 1985.
No, there's a different question I'm going to ask. Iwata spoke briefly about the upcoming milestone. It's been 30 years since the release of Super Mario Bros. In 1985. I couldn't be happier that Mario continues to be active across a wide range of games. I don't know about that. Thanks to no small part to the love you have for Mario. I'm extremely thankful. Nintendo's Mario Maker allows anyone to create levels and share them online with the world. Players can choose between four different graphic styles, from the 8-bit pixel art of the NES original to the rich graphics of the new Super Mario Bros. Series. It looks like the release of this anticipated Mario game isn't the only way Nintendo intends to celebrate Mario's upcoming milestone. As we approach Mario Maker's release, we'll be exploring fun ways to celebrate the 30th anniversary of Super Mario Bros. And my question is, well, if it's the 30th anniversary of Super Mario Bros., it's also going to be the 30th anniversary of Legend of Zelda.
Yeah, it'll be 3 years from now.
Oh, I thought it was released in 1985, Legend of Zelda.
No.
I could have sworn it was.
Nope, wasn't.
I'm gonna have to check that. So
possibly in Japan under another name, but no, that's wrong too.
Uh-huh.
It came out in either 86 or 87.
Okay. I think it's 1986.
I got it.
It was 86.
My whichever birthday. Yeah, told you.
It was 86. Okay, so yeah, next year is gonna be the 30th anniversary of Zelda. You know, actually, that's remember last week we talked about Legend of Zelda being delayed from 2015, and maybe, you know, it's not such a bad thing. They can just release the new Zelda as a 30th anniversary special. You know.
Yeah, but Zelda came out in 85. I don't
86.
Believe it 86. I don't really think it took off until 87.
I remember getting it on day one because I knew it had the gold.
You were the only person. I think that it took a while. It took a while for it to catch on.
I got it. It took a while. Available in the United States because I was looking forward to it, right? And I remember opening it and seeing the gold cartridge, and that's what really got me. I mean,
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was not that. You know, I was over a friend of a friend's house, and that's the only reason why I got interested, because it was the only one that was a gold cartridge. And so I played it for like 10 minutes. Oh, did I ever tell you? Jody, did I ever tell you about
the first... Before you go, you were right. It was released in North America in 1987. But I did get it on the first day.
It was released in North America in 1987. Right. I knew 86 was too early.
I knew I got it on day one. for the North American launch. I remember that.
You got it on August 22nd, 1987?
It must have been. I just remember getting it day one because I was really interested in it.
Are you sure? Think about it.
I'm pretty sure that I got it on the very first day of launch. As a matter of fact, you know, somewhere buried under all of that on my bookcase is the actual gold cartridge. Now, I'm pretty sure the 5-year battery is dead, but, you know.
Mine still works.
Well, you can replace the battery, right?
No, well, I've never had to. Mine still works.
Really? Oh, I have to. Yeah. Well, I do have an NES.
It may have deleted whatever save games were on there, but if I were to go and play it now and start a new one, it'll hold it for like 7 or 8 months.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, I do have, sitting in my living room, the launch NES as well, because that I got in 1985, right? Now I'm getting, now I know why I was thinking about 1985, because that was when the Nintendo launch in America was in like November.
Right, and it took a while to catch on. It still had to be marketed to toy stores as a toy robot, and by the time it was really popular, Rob had been discontinued.
I have my Rob sitting next to it. I do not have the light gun though. I don't know where my light gun went.
How do you not have two light guns? How do you not have the gray and the orange? You're not a real gamer. Get out of here.
You know,
you are dismissed, sir.
It's been 30 years.
Oh, to hell with you and your 30 years. You are dismissed, sir.
I'm not a hoarder like you, okay?
When I moved from New York to California, I had to get my I had to set a retail insurance value on my antique games collection. Mm. It was very high.
I didn't take care of any. I mean, I still have a few. I think I have my ColecoVision Ladybug game there in the box and some of this.
My Earthbound game alone is worth over $500.
I had a couple of like last year or 2 years ago, I actually tossed out my Amiga 500, threw it in the garbage because, one, I couldn't find the Kickstarter or the jump, the two discs that go with it. And also, you know, there's a time in which, you know, this thing is never going to be. It's never going to be valuable anyway. So,
well, you don't keep things because they're valuable.
I love my Amiga, but you know, this is just taking up too much space.
Weren't we talking about last week how we need to keep things in order to preserve the historical significance?
Yeah, but other people have saved the Amiga 500s and 1000s. I'm depending on them to do it for me.
Oh right, because you're just going to pass the buck. Okay, I see.
Yes, I'm passing the buck.
You're a buck passer.
So
I knew it.
We're going back to Mario Maker. Are you interested in making your own Mario levels?
That's what I do for a living.
But for
I mean, if you want to talk about one of the closest things that I do for a living, it would be that. It would be creating a toy box for Infinity. Mm-hmm. It would be doing maps for Heroes of Might and Magic.
Go back. Making a toy box for Infinity?
Yeah.
Is that like the toy box for Toy Story 3, the game?
Like, have you not played Infinity?
No. I don't have time to play other games than the ones that are sitting in front of me for the most part. No.
I particularly enjoy Disney's Infinity.
I didn't say I didn't like it. I just said I didn't play it.
Well, that is one of the main components, yes.
What is a toy box? Just a level editor or?
A level editor. That's kind of like a...
Taking stuff out of the box and just putting it down and...
Right. So, yes, it is building off of the engine that they made for Toy Story 2 or 3.
Right. Okay.
But it's better. But, I mean, within that, it does have, racing game pieces that you put up the start line, the finish line, and the different bonuses to collect. So, in that way, yes, that is kind of very similar to what I do for a living.
Okay. But... Do you think
part of what I do for a living?
Well, here's another question. Do you think this will have some cachet? Do you think people will go for it? Or do you think it'll be like a Little Big Planet in which there's a lot of hoopla about it, but really, you know, it's released and you have a lot of like a couple hundred thousand maps and all of them are mediocre and, you know.
Well, I think that's the problem is that everybody thinks that they can do it, but it takes talent and training to come up with something good. So you're right. You do end up with a whole lot of average stuff. And unless the moderation is there to kind of point players towards, you know, the better experiences, it does kind of tend to get really tedious, which is why I often look at, like, in Toy Box, when looking at other people's stuff, like, I often look at the developer's picks, because they're going to find the person who, and this is my favorite Toy Box ever, was some kid went and made, like, a 2-scale living room as if your Infinity figure jumped off the dresser.
Now I'm thinking about Andy's bedroom.
Right. Well, I mean, pretty much. So there, you know, you as the Infinity character, whichever one it is, run around the living room trying to turn on the video game arcade machine, which is in it. You then, once you turn it on, you can then climb up inside it. And at the very top, you could play a Space Invaders type game. And it's a nifty little toy box. It has a beginning, middle, and end. And it's like a complete story. Whereas, you know, the Pixie Hollow toy box that I came across the other day had nothing in it. Like, it was just like a really pretty set piece. Somebody just wanted to play with building trees and stuff. And there was like nothing, there was no gamey thing to do, you know?
You know, all this, you know, we've been going in a certain direction this week, and it leads back to last week's question of the week, which is this week's question of the week yet again. And it is, what do you think the future is of old games? And we still haven't heard from him because this podcast is being released way before anybody can write letters. So we're still listening for answers to that question.
Well, they would have had to have been extremely motivated to write in 2 days.
Yeah. Now, I was looking at the iTunes comments.
Yeah,
so there haven't been any new ones in 3 years, but what I found interesting is that the latest one was from Dynamic Jewel in 2012, and it was for Video Game Roundtable. It wasn't for Gaming Podcast, and I found that interesting that, you know, and we haven't heard from Dynamic Jewel in a long time. We haven't heard from a lot of people. I mean, even Arthur V, we haven't heard from in a while.
We have not heard from Arthur the Fifth.
And we haven't heard from Dynamic Jewel and all the other, you know, people who you loved. Because I know there was a lot of people that you enjoyed.
Oh, what happened to Max Donovan?
Oh, yeah. Well, you have to do it further away from your mouthpiece because I know you wanted to snap your fingers.
I did, and it didn't. I don't know if it came up.
No, it didn't. It sounded more like you were pounding on the thing. So just... It doesn't really. Yeah, but Max Donovan and all the other people, you know, we used to have a lot of. Now we just have people listening, and they just want to listen. They're not being active participants.
Here's the problem, guys. If we don't know you love us, the show doesn't go on.
Yeah, I mean, we live for your emails, or your.
Well, I live for your emails. I live for your emails. I have no life.
Wait, I'm not going to say it because you might be under an NDA. So.
I'm under several NDAs.
Ooh, see, he's...
So that's part of the problem, is that I often cannot talk about things that I want to talk about. So at times I kind of have to appear to be glib or to have no opinion because I can't talk about things.
So again, what role do you think old games will have in the future? Do you think they'll be remade, rebooted, you know, or is there just a nostalgia filter that makes us think all these old games are really good when they were actually just... limited, and we didn't know any better. I mean, there are some games that people like. When people play the original Perfect Dark, not the remake that was done on the Xbox One, you know, I think it was Perfect Dark Remastered. It's shocking to see how poor the gameplay is. And it's just that because it was a first-person shooter on the Nintendo Entertainment System.
Oh, my God. Even looking back at the original Kingdom Hearts, it's like, ugh. This control scheme is beat, and the polygon count is so horrible.
So, yeah, so do these games have a future in video games, or are we just going to let our culture die a withered death? Well, I don't know if that was the intent of the question, but, you know.
Well, what do you think is going to hold for the future of and preservation of old games?
Yeah. I would plug...
Like, are people, like 10 years from now, are people going to be able to play Candy Crush for its historical context?
I would suggest buying or subscribing to a retro magazine, which actually is a magazine devoted to retro games, and they talk about a lot of interesting stuff that I didn't even know existed, you know? The last issue, you'd like this, Paul, dealt with a lot about adventure games and went through the history of it, talking about King's Quest and how it, you know, And what's really interesting is that when the designer of King's Quest decided to remake it and give it a graphic interface, you know, a point-and-click interface, mm-hmm. not the text parser, he found that it made everything a lot more limited because people were used to having, you know, 256 words, and now it's more like 4 or 5 words, you know? And he had to really jump through hoops to get the same amount of interaction because okay. when they went with the graphic interface, it was a lot less interaction, you know, so to speak. You know,
I don't know that I can agree with that point of view.
Well, I was a developer. I mean, you know, if I had the copy of the issue here for to show you, I would send it to you.
I mean, we're talking the difference between, I mean, try to imagine what would happen if you were tried to release a text RPG on the iPad today. Like, what? People are going to read? No, I don't think so. whereas, you know, like, working with a graphical interface now, which is every video game, and especially on an iOS device where you're, or any tablet really, where you're going to tap, you know, to interact, I kind of think that maybe he found it frustrating at the time, but both the industry and the audience have learned to appreciate the flexibility of a graphic interface. Because everything's a graphic interface now.
Yeah.
And in fact, the city of Los Angeles is running a test to revamp all the parking signs to graphic representations of a schedule so that people know when they can and cannot park places.
No. The website for the magazine is readretro.com. I don't know if they have the article about point-and-click adventure games on the site, but if you can find it there, you'll read what I was talking about. But the thing is, it may not be there. You may have to wait a while because it is a kickstarted magazine. So it's sort of like, you know, they're not going to cut off the knees of the people who backed the magazine by releasing all the articles online right away, because they do have articles, but I think it's from past issues. So I don't know. Maybe like 3 months from now, you'll see the article there.
Because we all know how much I love anything associated with Kickstarter.
Well, it's a magazine though. It's a pretty well designed magazine too.
I'm sure it is.
I have
adopted a stigma associated with the word Kickstarter.
Read Retro is the name of the website. Well, one of the things I'm playing is Pillars of Eternity, and it's great. It's one of the if anybody ever wanted to show what good Kickstarter could do, they just have to look at Pillars of Eternity. Because I'll say this about Wasteland 2. It's hard as hell, and you know, I don't even consider it fun. You know, it's more like work. Pillars of Eternity, on the other hand, is fun. You know, not to mention the story is great, the dialogue is great, the interaction is great. You know, I mean, Chris Avellone, who both of us know, by the way. I don't know to what degree you know him, but what's it called? We've met and chatted a lot. As a matter of fact, you know, there was a distinct possibility I was going to try and do voiceover work, but it was too late. So, but you know, it's just a great game, and it's been picked up by Paradox. So if you want to buy it, you can buy it from Paradox Interactive. So
neat.
Yeah. So, but like I said, you know, there's, you know, one of these days we're going to devote an entire episode to debate the have a single topic episode about Kickstarter, right? And just talk about, you know, what it does.
I have no desire to take part in that conversation.
The pros, the cons, you know. I'm pretty sure you would. I mean, it is a time.
No, I'm telling you that I have no desire.
Why is that? Why is
because Kickstarter has become so stigmatized, at least in my mind, of people getting ripped off and investing in things that never pan out because the people who put these projects up never have any intention of fulfilling their promises.
What about just crowdfunding period, like Indiegogo or GoFundMe or Patreon? Patreon has been a big thing lately.
Any kind of crowdfunding Kickstarter-esque activity sets off all sorts of red alarms to me right now. And you know what? In 4 or 5 years, when our quote-unquote new economy finally stabilizes and people don't have one job anymore, they have 4 jobs, and our society is kind of okay with this, maybe the perception of crowdfunding will change because more people will have you know, correctly estimated how much money they're going to need, and projects will reach completion. But for right now, it's just kind of like, I mean, it just kind of at now seems like the Craigslist of video games ads.
Yikes.
You know? I mean, well, how many
Paul,
times have you seen
on the... There.
I mean, how many times have you seen, you know, horror stories about Craigslist? It's unmoderated. It's unsupervised. It just kind of feels the same way with crowdfunding activities.
You know, lately I've just been backing board games because they're a lot more stable. Because the thing about board games is that you know exactly how much you have to buy, pay for components, right? And when you have stretch goals, it isn't to add stuff to the game more than it is to get better crafted components, like better dice or better cards or a thicker stock card. You know,
it just it feels like everybody pitching on a crowdfunding site
but
comes across as a really sleazy used car salesman or real estate investor. And I am wary of it, and I know that more and more people are becoming wary of it.
I think this is definitely going to be a subject we should tackle in the near
future. Well, I've said all I need. I've said all I have to say on the subject.
Well, maybe not. I mean, you know what? Anyways, you know, going back to our original question of the week, what is the future of old games? We'd love to hear from you on it. And, you know, we'd love to hear from anybody right now. And sorry about the quick turnaround, but, you know, we do normally record on a Friday and we need to get back on track. Because of the holiday season and also the conventions like GDC and PAX East and all that stuff, we've had to adjust our schedules just to do the podcast, you know. And I'd like to get back, and I'm pretty sure Paul would, you know, into a more stable, more you know, time slot that, you know, we can rely on, so that we can, okay, we're doing this at this time, you know, and we could schedule around it.
We're working on it. The problem is working as a freelancer, I often have very little control over my schedule. So while I might be able to run and take care of an errand or a doctor's appointment in the afternoon, oftentimes I'm, you know, I have an overnight deadline, which means I don't get to talk to anybody.
Okay, so well,
so it's just kind of rough. We're trying, guys. Bear with me.
Yeah. So we will see you next week. Hopefully we will hear from you by next week. That's what we want. You can sign off.
Oh, are we signing off?
Yeah.
Oh, bye, Bonds.
See you later.